Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland, episode 43.2, An Early Death. So yes, we are back with part 2. Make sure you've listened to the early part, that is episode 43.1, An Early Death, where we go over basically everything from up to now. So we went from 1159 to about 1163. We are now going to carry on from 1163 and discuss the revolt in the region of Moray. So please make sure you have listened to the previous episodes, where it is crucial to follow Malcolm IV's lineage. Again, apologies for splitting this episode up into two parts, but really I didn't want the episode to be ridiculously long at 45 minutes. So that's why it's been split up. But anyway, unlike last week, we won't do a lot of intro stuff. We're going to jump straight back in to where the episode left off. So, everyone, hope you're ready to jump back in to Malcolm IV's reign and get ready to say goodbye to a king that may have not equaled David I's legendary status, but he certainly set the crucial foundations for one of Scotland's longest reigning monarchs, William the Lion. So, let us jump back in. To quick recap, the latter part of Malcolm IV's reign was marked by significant challenge. A revolt in the region of Moray happened. This northern Scottish province had been a long hotbed of resistance and power struggles, as we know. It was a legacy that could be traced back to figures like Macbeth. Oh, they were simpler times. Its strategic importance and history of autonomy made it a recurring focal point of internal conflict in Scotland. Historical sources from Scotland recount a dramatic response by Malcolm to this uprising. In an action reminiscent of ancient rulers, Malcolm IV is said to have forcibly removed the men of Moray from their lands. This drastic measure involved dispersing them throughout the various regions of Scotland, both north and south of Monmouth, effectively ensuring that none of the original inhabitants remained in Moray. Such a response was not only a military manoeuvre, but also a strategic attempt to break the cycle of rebellion in Moray by displacing its people. At the heart of this turmoil was the Mormaer of Moray. The exact identity of the Mormaer during Malcolm's reign is not definitely recorded, but it's likely that he was a member of the MacHeath or MacWilliam families, both whom had historical claims and connections to the region. The reasons for the Mormaer's revolt stem from a range of issues, from local autonomy and resistance to the centralising policies of the Scottish monarchy, to the more personal grievances against Malcolm's rule. Moray's reputation as a stronghold for revolts was well earned. Its geographical position made it a crucial area for anyone seeking to control the north of Scotland. Furthermore, its history of being ruled by powerful local figures such as Macbeth meant that it had a tradition of relative independence and resistance to the central authority of the Scottish kings. This ongoing tension made Moray a continual source of concern for Malcolm IV, as it had been for his predecessors. The revolt in Moray and Malcolm's response to it was significant for several reasons. It highlighted the ongoing challenges of maintaining control over Scotland's diverse regions, especially those with a history of autonomy like Moray. Malcolm's drastic response also indicated his willingness to take severe measures to secure his rule, reflecting the harsh realities of medieval kingship. Additionally, this event demonstrated the complex interplay of local and national politics in Scotland. During this period, a theme that would continue to shape Scotland's history in the centuries to come. In 1164, though, the political landscape of Scotland was further dramatically reshaped by the resurgence of Somerled, a formidable figure in Scottish history. Somerled, known for his influence and power in the Isles and parts of mainland Scotland, had previously dabbled in supporting claimants to the Scottish throne during the early years of Malcolm IV's reign. However, he had refrained from full commitment, if you remember to our first episode on Malcolm IV. This was likely due to the complex interplay of regional and national politics. This year marked a turning point when Somerled marshalled a significant force comprising of Islesmen, Irishmen, and he launched an assault on Glasgow and Renfrew. This move was strategic, targeting a newly completed castle in Renfrew, which was a symbol of the Scottish crown increasing influence in the region. The castle was actually in construction by Walter FitzAlan, the prominent Norman noble that we mentioned last week, who was also the first highest steward of Scotland. This stronghold was not just a military fortification, but also represented the expanding Norman influence under the Scottish crown, a development that figures like Somerled viewed with increasing alarm. Sumled's decision to attack was motivated by several factors. Firstly, it was a response to the growing encroachment of Scottish monarchy and its Norman allies into territories that Sumled and others considered their sphere of influence. By striking at Glasgow and Renfrew, Sumled was challenging this expansion and asserting his own power and autonomy. Moreover, this attack can be seen as part of Sumled's broader strategy to maintain and expand his domain, which included parts of the Western mainland and Hebrides. His efforts were not just about territorial gain, they were also about preserving the traditional Gaelic Norse way of life and governance, which was increasingly under threat from the centralising and Normanisation of policies of the Scottish monarchy. Sumled's actions in 1164 were significant for several reasons. They underscored the ongoing divisions within Scotland between the Gaelic Norse lords of the Isles and the Scottish crown. These conflicts were not merely territorial disputes, but also rooted in deeper cultural and political differences. Furthermore, Sumled's assault was a bold statement against the perceived overreach of Malcolm IV's government. It highlighted the limitations of royal authority in Scotland, particularly in regions like the Isles, where traditional power structures and loyalties remained strong. What did Sumled's army consist of, however? He was the Lord of the Isles and Argyll. He was able to execute a daring military manoeuvre. So, how big was this army? Well, if we take a look, with an impressive fleet of 164 galleys, he disembarked a massive army of 15,000 men at Greenock, aiming to seize Renfrew. This bold action was not just a demonstration of Sumled's naval prowess, but also a testament to his ambition and his challenge to the Scottish monarchy's authority. This army would have comprised of lightly armoured infantry, maybe some skirmishers, probably lacking in cavalry, but his impressive fleet on the waters was a symbolic part. He had a strong navy because he was from the Isles, and the Isles are obviously interconnecting islands in Scotland. Have a look at the map of Scotland on Google or something, and you'll understand what I mean in terms of the Isles and Argyll and why such an impressive fleet of 164 galleys isn't actually crazy for Sumled to have. Anyway, the confrontation that ensued, known as the Battle of Renfrew, was a defining moment in the struggle for power and influence in medieval Scotland. Sumled's forces were well equipped and battle hardened. They posed a significant threat. However, they were met by a determined resistance, led by an unlikely military commander, the Bishop of Glasgow. The bishop leading the Scottish forces was likely Herbert of Selkirk. His involvement in the battle raised eyebrows, as it was unusual for a churchman to take on such a direct military role in these times. If you cast your mind back to the Anglo-Saxon times, in the Anglo-Saxon times it wasn't actually crazy for bishops and clergymen to lead armies into battle. But going into the medieval times now, this has kind of changed. Or at least, we thought it had. However, the circumstances of the time, with the kingdom under threat, called for extraordinary measures. Bishops during this era were not just spiritual leaders, but also wielded considerable secular power and influence, as we know in the past few episodes. Think of the debates with David I. Herbert's leadership in the battle underscores the vital role of the church in the kingdom's political and military affairs. The battle's outcome hinged on a combination of tactical acumen, effective use of terrain, and, as the chronicles suggest, divine intervention. The Scottish forces, though outnumbered, managed to utilise the landscape effectively, likely using guerrilla tactics and ambushes to offset the numerical advantage of Sumled's army. The terrain around Renfrew, with its mix of rugged hills and marshy grounds, would have been a challenging foe for the large invading force, especially one accustomed to naval warfare and island terrain. The chronicles of the day, particularly those with the ecclesiastical learnings, attributed the victory to the intercession of Saint Kenincon, reflecting the period's deep religious sentiment. This claim, while spiritual in nature, also served to enhance the church's standing and the divine rule of the Scottish crown. The battle's climax was marked by the deaths of Sumled and his son, a significant blow to the aspirations of the Islesmen and their allies. Their demise not only marked the end of a formidable challenge to Scottish royal authority, but also heralded a shift in balance of power in the region. I think what's crucial about this battle is a couple of things. First, it's the first proper testament of using guerrilla tactics and the terrain to Scotland's advantage, something we'll see a lot in the English invasion to come. You know, not fighting proper pitched battles and actually using guerrilla tactics to weaken your army, play some mind games, sever those crucial supply lines, and then set up your army for battle. And thanks to the Bishop of Glasgow's military acumen, they were able to do this. And obviously the second part is actually something we haven't really touched upon, the Isles themselves. With Somerled and his son defeated and dead, this would actually mark one of the final ends to the Isles as the island nation. And in the future, they will eventually come under the control of the Scottish throne as we know. And if I'm honest, Somerled's invasion was the last great invasion of the island and Islesmen. And after this, they kind of fade. You know, their military prowess, their independence starts to wane, and the Scottish king at the time, which we'll obviously get to in the future, does eventually take over the Isles and become ruler of the Isles. But that's something we'll get to when we get to this king's rule. I'm not going to spoil who which king it is yet. In summary though, the Battle of Renfrew, fought under the unlikely leadership of Bishop Herbert, was not just a military victory for Malcolm IV of Scotland, but also a moment of great symbolic importance. It reinforced the monarchy's authority, showcased the strategic role of the church in secular affairs, and marked the beginning of the end of Somerled's era of influence. This battle was a testament to the complexity of Scottish medieval politics, where the ecclesiastical and secular spheres often intertwined in the pursuit of power and stability. The death of Somerled at the battle marked a turning point for Malcolm, though. As a young king confronting numerous internal challenges, Malcolm's reaction to this event was pivotal. Sources suggest that he viewed Somerled's death as a significant relief, eliminating a formidable rival who had consistently challenged the Scottish crown's authority. However, Malcolm's reaction was not merely one of triumph, but also strategic contemplation. Understanding the implication of Somerled's demise, Malcolm likely sought to consolidate power and restore royal authority in the regions previously under Somerled's influence. This period likely saw Malcolm IV engage in diplomatic and strategic manoeuvres to strengthen his position and prevent any power vacuum that might arise in the Isles and Argyll. The death of Somerled, a key figure in the region, left this power vacuum that would have had a significant implication for Galloway and the surrounding areas. Galloway, a region known for its independent spirit and frequent resistance to the Scottish crown, would have been impacted by the shifting power dynamics. In the aftermath, the leaders of Galloway, including the powerful Lord of Galloway, would have reassessed their positions. They might have sought to capitalise on the new power landscape, either by asserting more independence or by realigning with the Scottish crown to ensure the interests were protected in the new political order. Think of obviously our councillor that we mentioned in last week's episode, the Lord of Galloway. He accompanied Malcolm across to France. He would now take a bit more of a significant role in Galloway in politics and become Malcolm's man on the ground. The death of Somerled did not immediately lead to peace throughout Scotland. While it removed a significant source of conflict, Malcolm IV's reign continued to be marked by challenges, including revolts and power struggles both within the Scottish nobility and from neighbouring kingdoms. Malcolm's efforts post-1164 would have focused on stabilising his rule, dealing with internal dissent and managing the complex network of alliances and enmities that characterised Scottish politics at the time. The period following Somerled's death was likely one of cautious rebuilding and royal assertion of authority, rather than outright peace. The events at the Battle of Renfrew and their aftermath were pivotal in shaping Malcolm IV's reign. They provided an opportunity for him to reassert this control and navigate the rest of the political landscape in Scotland. While it did not bring immediate peace as we know, it gave Malcolm time to address the myriad challenges that continued to define his time as king. Malcolm IV's personal life, however, particularly his romantic relationships, is notably sparse in detail, reflecting perhaps a young king's focus on this governance and turbulent nature of his reign. A significant episode, however, was the proposed marriage between Malcolm and Constance in 1160. This alliance was considered a strategic move, strengthening ties with Brittany. Constance's brother, Conan IV, had already married Malcolm's sister Margaret, which would have made this marriage a reinforcement of familial and political bonds. However, Constance refused Malcolm's proposal. Her aspirations leaning towards marrying the French king, Louis, this rejection might have been a diplomatic setback for Malcolm, who remained unmarried throughout his reign. His bachelor status was unusual for kings of the time, where marriages were key in forging alliances and securing the succession. So, who would be the heir apparent? Well, Henry of Huntingdon, Malcolm IV's father, had another son, and obviously this would be Malcolm's brother, and we know him as William, who would be later known as William the Lion, our future king and one of Scotland's most longest reigning monarchs. And just a quick cap on this, we will be doing about 6 to 7 episodes on William the Lion, so get ready for that. It's going to rival the rule of David the First, even if it's a bit more turbulent in nature. Anyway, William, who would be later known as this, was a significant figure during this period, with a personality and physicality starkly contrasting that of his brothers. Malcolm's view of William, given their contrasting dispositions, would have been quite a complex relationship. Malcolm, known for his frail health and deep religious conviction, was quite different from William, who was robust, red-headed, and known for his assertiveness and vigour. This contrast might have caused Malcolm to have concerns about how William would lead Scotland, especially in the wake of his own more pious and restrained approach. Despite these differences, it is likely that Malcolm recognised the strengths that William brought to the table. His physical prowess and headstrong nature were qualities that could be deemed necessary for a monarch in a period marked by internal strife and external threats. And I don't think it's far-fetched to think that the nobles would prefer William over Malcolm as well. Malcolm's decision to designate William as his successor, despite their differences, indicates a level of respect and understanding of the needs of the kingdom between the two brothers. The difference in stature between the two brothers was not just physical, but also in their style of leadership, as we've said. Malcolm's rule was characterised by the focus on piety, internal consolidation and dealing with revolts, often struggling with his health and the challenges of leading as a young monarch. He wasn't even focused on getting married, he had no kids, and this is quite a serious thing for a medieval king. Being unmarried, having no kids to be able to marry off for alliances, apart from obviously your sisters, etc., it's quite crucial to have this in place. So, you know what? Malcolm's kind of failed on that approach for me in terms of the romantic side. William, on the other hand, would come to be known for his assertiveness and more confrontational approach, particularly in dealing with external threats and asserting Scotland's independence. The relationship between Malcolm IV and William the Lion, marked by their differences in health, personality and leadership style, adds a fascinating dynamic to this period of Scottish history. Malcolm's reign, with William as the heir apparent, sets the stage for a significant shift in the monarchy's approach and priorities. William's eventual ascension to the throne following Malcolm's death brings a new chapter to Scotland's story, contrasting significantly with the reign of his deeply religious and frail brother. As the year 1165 AD dawned, King Malcolm IV of Scotland was only 24 years old, yet his health was rapidly declining. His physical frailty and constant companion throughout his life had begun to take a more serious toll. This decline was not just a personal struggle for Malcolm, it was a matter of state, given the king's central role in the medieval political system. In his final days, Malcolm found himself in Jedburgh, a place of considerable strategic importance. This wasn't merely a retreat from ailing health, it was a location pivotal for his proximity to the volatile English border. Jedburgh's significance in the defence and administration of the kingdom was undeniable, and Malcolm's presence there, despite his failing health, speaks to the gravity of the geopolitical tensions of the time. It is believed that Malcolm's health was undermined by Pagan's disease, a chronic condition characterized by the abnormal breakdown and formation of bone tissue. This illness can lead to bone pain, misshapen bones, and eventually serious complications. In a time when royal appearances and physical prowess bore significant weight, this condition would have severely impacted Malcolm's ability to fulfill the demanding duties of kingship. As Malcolm's condition worsened, those within his inner circle, including his trusted advisors and possibly his brother William, gathered at his side. The atmosphere in Jedburgh would have been sombre, filled with the heavy realization that the kingdom was about to lose its sovereign. In his last hours, it is likely that a cleric was summoned to deliver the last rites, a crucial ritual in the medieval Christian world, ensuring the king's spiritual passage. This solemn moment would have been observed by those closest to him, his brother, the advisors we went through in the last episode. This marked the end of a reign that would have been fraught with challenges both internal and external. Sadly, Malcolm was not to recover from this episode. Laying on his deathbed, he would have turned to his brother, William, entrusting the kingdom to him, making him promise to follow in his grandfather's footsteps, David I, carry on the Norman transitions of power and the Davidonian Revolution, and keep the kingdom together at all costs. Keep the family going. Malcolm passed away on the 9th of December, 1165. Scotland found itself in a state of mourning and transition. The reaction to his death would have varied. While some may have mourned the loss of the king genuinely, like his brother and his key advisors, others, particularly those who had opposed his rule, might have viewed his passing as an opportunity for change or advancement. With Malcolm's death, the mantle of leadership was set to pass to his brother, William the Lion. This transition, occurring in the shadow of Malcolm's premature demise, would have been laden with both opportunity and uncertainty. Jedburgh, the site of Malcolm's death, remains a place of historical significance. Visitors to the area can still feel the echoes of the past, where a young king spent his final days grappling with a kingdom in flux and its own morality. In hindsight, Malcolm IV's reign, though brief and marred by illness, was a crucial period in Scottish history. Malcolm IV ruled for only 12 years in Scotland, but those 12 years were still critical to keep the kingdom together, especially after such a pivotal rule of David I, carrying on the Norman transitions of power, carrying on the Davidonian Revolution. Just to remind you, he was 12 when he was crowned King of Scotland at Scone. Struggles with health, his efforts to maintain stability, and his untimely death at a young age all contribute to the narrative of the king who faced considerable challenges in a time of significant change, ushered in from his grandfather. Malcolm's story is a poignant reminder of the fragility of human life and the burdens of leadership in the medieval world. The death of King Malcolm IV in 1165 was met with a mix of sorrow and happiness across Scotland. While Malcolm's rule had been marred by frailty and challenges, he was still the sovereign, a symbol of continuity and stability in the medieval realm. His passing, though not entirely unexpected given his ill health, would have been a somber moment for the kingdom. The general populace, whose lives were deeply intertwined with the land and local governance, may not have felt the direct impact from the king's death. However, there was likely a sense of uncertainty about the future, a common sentiment when a monarch passes. Among the nobility, reactions would have been varied. For some, Malcolm's death signified the end of a reign that had been less than forceful, perhaps even a relief for those who found Malcolm's rule too passive or ineffective. Others may have genuinely mourned the loss of their king, like the close advisors we mentioned in the past episode, their concern about the stability and direction of the kingdom under a new ruler. As preparations began for William the Lion to assume the throne, there was a possible palpable sense of a new chapter opening in Scotland's history. William, known for his strong personality and physical presence, contrasted sharply with his brother's more subdued character. This change in leadership style brought both hope and apprehension. The transition appears to have been smooth, with no significant opposition to William's ascension. This could have been attributed to the recognition of his rightful claim and possible relief at the prospect of a more assertive and robust leadership style. The crowning of William the Lion would have been a grand affair, steeped in the tradition and symbolism. Preparations for this event would have been massive, ensuring that all rituals and ceremonies were observed to legitimise and celebrate the new king's ascension. This event was not just a formality, but a public display of continuity and strength of the Scottish monarchy. The details of the coronation, from the religious ceremonies to the feasts and public declarations at Scone, all played a crucial role in establishing William's authority and setting the tone for his reign. But we will pick up William the Lion in our next episode with him, where we'll discuss how he was crowned at Scone, what type of traditions were followed, how did the crowning process differ from England's crowning process, and what was the Stone of Destiny and all these other great pivotal moments in a crowning of Scotland's monarch. So again, we'll cover that at the start of William's reign, where we pick up from him next time. As we conclude this chapter on Malcolm IV, the stage is set for William the Lion, a ruler whose long tenure and actions would leave a lasting imprint on Scottish history. His reign, filled with notable events and significant shifts in Scottish medieval politics, promises to be an intriguing journey exploring the complexities of a king who would fight tirelessly for Scotland's independence and prestige. In the next episodes, we will dive into Malcolm's reign, unravelling the layers of his rule, the challenges he faced, and the legacy left behind. The story of Scotland continues, with it the unfolding narrative of the nation's undying and enduring spirit. As I mentioned, William the Lion would later be one of Scotland's most longest reigning monarchs, up until about James I level. So, with this in mind, I am going to be doing about 6 or 7 episodes, as I mentioned, so be prepared for a massive tale of stories diving deep into William's reign. Think of David I's episodes, except I don't think it will be quite as productive as David I, as we'll soon find out. Anyway, let's go back to our dead and deceased Malcolm IV. The historical assessment of Malcolm IV, the maiden king of Scotland, is a study in contrasts. Contemporary chroniclers, like the compiler of the Annals of Ulster, saw Malcolm in a favourable light. They lauded him as a pious and charitable Christian ruler. The Annals of Ulster notably praised Malcolm as the High King of Scotland, the best Christian that was of the Gaels by sea, and on the east of Aindeeds, hospitality and piety. Similarly, William of Newbury, in his Historia Referrum Anglicorum, extolled Malcolm as the most Christian king of Scots, highlighting his devoutness and possibly his adherence to the church's guidance in ruling the kingdom. However, not all opinions were so glowing. The Gesta Annalia presents a more critical view, suggesting Malcolm neglected the care and governance of his kingdom. This source portrays him as unpopular, especially among the common people, potentially due to the perceived weakness or failures in leadership. It also indicates a strained relationship with his brother, who would later become William the Lion, one of Scotland's most significant monarchs. Despite these criticisms, however, Malcolm IV seems to have continued the administrative reforms initiated by his grandfather David I and its granduncles. The establishment of the sheriffdoms in Grail, Dunfermline, Edinburgh, Forfar, Lanark and Lithgow, as well as the office of the Justiciar of Lothian, are believed to have occurred during Malcolm's reign. These reforms indicate a continued effort to strengthen the central administration and judicial process in Scotland. What is a justiciar and a sheriffdom? Well, a justiciar was a crucial role in medieval Scotland, essentially serving as the king's chief judicial officer. Think of our dead Donnchad Mormaer. His son, Donnchad II, became the justiciar of the Scots, or the Northern Scots. The justiciar was responsible for the administration of justice, overseeing the courts and ensuring the enforcement of laws across the kingdom. This position was a testament to the growing sophistication and centralisation of royal power and governance in Scotland. A sheriffdom was an administrative and judicial district governed by a sheriff appointed by the king. The sheriff was responsible for maintaining law and order, overseeing the local courts, and collecting taxes within their area. This establishment of sheriffdoms represented a significant advancement in the kingdom's organisational structure, facilitating more effective local governance and law enforcement. So the fact that David I initiated this and Malcolm IV, rather than change it and revert back to the old Gaelic ways, carried this on further and made sure more sheriffdoms were created, especially in places like Crail, Dunfermline, Edinburgh, Lanark and Lithgow. It shows Malcolm IV's commitment to his grandfather's legacy. And to be honest, William the Lion's later reign, it would carry on. But Malcolm IV laying these further foundations enabled Scotland to continue to grow in this European context. Malcolm IV's reign was marked not only by political and military endeavours, but also by significant religious contributions. His founding of a Cistercian monastery at Cupar Angus exemplifies his commitment to the church and its institutions. This act was part of a broader trend among Scottish nobility, mirroring the actions of magnates in Galloway, where they established the sole seat around 1161 AD. These foundations reflected the royal and noble taste for continental religious orders, indicative of Scotland's increasing alignment with the broader European ecclesiastical movements. Chroniclers and historians throughout the ages would have offered a diverse view on Malcolm IV's reign. While some, as previously noted, praised his piety and Christian virtues, others focused on the challenges and shortcomings of his rule. Some historians perceived Malcolm as a transitional figure, navigating the complex landscape of a kingdom still solidifying its national identity amidst external pressures and internal factionalism. From a broader historical perspective, Malcolm IV can be seen as neither an exceptional monarch nor a failed one. His reign, though short and marred with ill health, was pivotal in maintaining the continuity of the Scottish kingdom and the Davidonian Revolution. Malcolm managed to quell internal rebellions and navigated the intricate dynamics of the Scottish-Norman relationships. His concessions of lands to the English crown to Henry II, while criticised for diminishing Scotland's stature, may have been pragmatic decisions in the context of the time, aimed at maintaining peace and stability. Malcolm's reign set the stage for future rulers of Scotland, particularly his brother William the Lion. Despite his frailty and brevity of his rule, Malcolm IV played a crucial role in the continuity of this Scottish monarchy story. He kept the kingdom intact during a period of potential vulnerability, enabling his successor to usher in what would be considered a golden age of Scottish rule. In conclusion, Malcolm IV's reign, while not marked by grand conquests or sweeping reforms, was crucial in this historical narrative of Scotland. As we conclude our exploration of Malcolm IV's reign, it's essential to recognise the sources that have illuminated our journey through this pivotal period in Scottish history. Our understanding of Malcolm's era has been enriched by various historical texts that I have read and chroniclers. Key among these are the Annals of Ulster and William Newbery's Historia Rifera Anglorica, which provide contrasting perspectives on Malcolm's rule. Geoffrey Barrow's scholarly works, as always, particularly those focusing on the Scottish nobility dynamics, have offered valuable insights into the political landscape of 12th century Scotland. And the Gesta Annalia also provides crucial commentary on Malcolm's reign and its challenges. So if you want any further reading, please go through and look at those sources. And I also apologise for butchering some of those sources' names as well. Reflecting on Malcolm IV's rule, it becomes clear that his short tenure as king, while not filled with the dramatic conquests or grand reformations that hallmark the reigns of other monarchs, was nonetheless a significant period of transition and consolidation for Scotland. His rule was a bridge between the foundations laid by the great David I and the forthcoming expansive era under William the Lion. Next time, we'll embark on the exciting journey through the reign of William the Lion, one of Scotland's longest ruling monarchs. His reign promises to be a rich tapestry of political intrigue, cultural shifts, and significant developments in Scottish history. But before we delve into William's reign, you'll notice I've said next time and not next week. Our next episode will take another detour into the daily life of 12th century Scotland. Instead, we are now going to be learning about the laws, languages, and culture during this transformative century. How did the everyday Scot live, speak, and navigate the legal frameworks of their time? How did the Davidonian Revolution impact the cultural and linguistic landscape of Scotland? These questions and more will be our focus, setting the stage for a deeper understanding of the period that William the Lion inherited. So in short, we're going to look at the laws of Scotland during this time, the languages that were being spoke, you know, because obviously we've got the Gaelic languages, the French, Norman languages, etc. And obviously what cultures were around. I've already mentioned quite a few times now, we've got the Norman cultures, we've got the Gaelic Scot cultures, but it's actually more in depth than that. And I think it's only right we do an episode exploring all this diverseness in Scotland during 12th century Scotland. Remember, history is not just about the actions of kings and battles, it's also about understanding the social and cultural currents that flow beneath the surface of major events. We've got an exciting journey ahead of us, as I've mentioned in the past episode, with no less than 45 episodes planned out. I know, it's crazy. I've planned all the way up to, I think, episode 102. So there's a wealth of Scottish history still to uncover, and I can't wait to delve into it with all of you. We've got all the great kings coming up in greater depth, at least 3 episodes for the shorter kings. But when we get to kings such as Robert the Bruce, they're going to be lasting with us for about 13 to 14 episodes. So I hope you're ready for the in-depth nature that this podcast is going to be taking going forward. With the sources being more prevalent, with books I'm able to read a lot more easier now, it's going to be, yeah, we're going to have a good time. A quick reminder though that our podcasts are released weekly and our next episode will be available next week as always. We're committed to bringing you 3 episodes each month, each one packed with fascinating insights into Scotland's past. Now you're probably thinking, is the next episode next week the last one since we are approaching Christmas and New Year? It won't be. There will actually be 4 episodes this month. I'm planning to release another episode at some point next week, and then there'll be an episode before the new year, so look out for that. We also have approaching episode 50. Now, when we get probably 3 or 4 episodes before episode 50, so maybe in 3-4 weeks time, I'm going to be releasing a survey on our Facebook page and Twitter where you can actually ask me questions. And this episode 50 is going to be a place where I can do a Q&A, ask questions about myself, my interest in history, my interest in Scottish history, anything you want. It's a Q&A. So episode 50 will be a special Q&A episode. So get your questions lined up. You can email us at thehistoryofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com or contact me on the Facebook group page or Twitter. I'll be collecting them officially at a later date. So keep a good eye out for that, but I thought I'd give a bit of an advance warning. As well as episode 2 of this podcast being redone towards the end of the year as well. I keep saying it every month. I need to commit to it. So hopefully the holidays I can get it redone so our earlier listeners don't need to listen to the toaster mic after episode 1 that is happening from episodes 2 to 9. Anyway, don't forget to stay connected with us. Follow our Twitter account at thehistoryofsc1. That is at thehistoryofsc1 for latest updates and an engaging historical content. Join our vibrant community on the History of Scotland podcast Facebook page, where we share additional resources, discussions, and insights into the episodes. We've actually hit 52 members in the group on Facebook, so thank you for that. Your feedback is invaluable to us. Please leave a review on your preferred podcast platform if you can. Let us know what you enjoy and what you'd like to hear more about. This helps us improve and continue bringing you the history you love. Thank you for the couple of extra reviews, both 5 stars on the US Apple podcast site and the UK podcast, Apple podcast site. It's interesting to see that even though our main audience is from Spotify, that's where all our reviews come from. It's really cool to see that Apple podcast is expanding our viewership and we're actually number 1 now on there for Scottish history podcasts as well, which is cool. But as always, you can listen to our episodes on various platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Podbean, and many other great podcasting sites. So whether you're at home or on the go, we're there to accompany you with the tales from Scotland's rich history. Thank you for joining us on this journey through Scotland's past. Have a great week, guys. Hope you're enjoying December and getting all into the Christmas spirit. We'll be back next week with a fascinating tale on the lore, culture, and language of Scottish 12th century. So until then, stay safe, and I'll catch you all on the next one. Peace.